Welcome back to Books, Films, Tilly. Today we're going to be discussing The Perks of Being a Wallflower by Stephen Chbosky, originally published in 1999. It was later adapted in the year 2012. I really need to get a little jingle going for the podcast. I actually should do a bunch of things, but we'll get over ourselves. I don't know, I think it's jarring me because I'm like, oh, what do I want it to sound like? And I'm over-focusing on that rather than the fact that it would be so much easier if I had a jingle so that I didn't have to do the introduction every single time and then worry about the way that my voice sounds in the introduction. I'm really sorry this is coming out a week late. I'm fully blaming it on the rats, but I probably could have found a way around it. It was bugging me way too much and I don't have that much 4G. But yeah, we're here. We're gonna do this. I'm really excited. I think this is probably one of my favourite books I've read for the podcast so far. But before we get started, it's been another week of the Bridgerton fandom slating poor Luke Newton under the guise of concern over season 3. Lady Charlotte came out last week, the spin-off series. It's set between season 2 and season 3 of Bridgerton, and it's been very popular, and everyone's been fawning over Corey, who plays King George. So there's been a lot of silly behavior, and this isn't the Bridgerton episode, by the way. I'm still debating on whether to do it or maybe to save a Bridgerton episode for the summer when I can do it with BB, because I'd like to do a debut from season 2, which would be nice to do with Bubs because she's my sister, and a lot of season 2 is on the dynamics between siblings as well as the romance aspect. And also, if I do it more in the summer, it'll be closing to season 3. But I just feel like people really, really, really need to stop focusing on, like, physical appearance when it comes to rom-coms and, like, main characters in romances in general. Because it's annoying me. It's really pissing me off, and I think it's really rude. And oftentimes not true as well. So just, I know for most of you this is a complete sidetrack, but I'm going to try and keep it somewhat. This is educational. Take it as educational. Take it as you're learning something new. So quick lesson on romance, mainly in books, but also in films, because if you pull off what books are able to do, then that makes the film or series like a top tier romance. It's all, everything to do with romance, everything is in the bloody details. I keep saying this. I'm a details person. I think you know that by now. But also, like, humans, we are details people. We do weird little things to catch people's attention or to let them know that we care, or we let out our feelings subconsciously through the things that we do. So what makes a good romance, is not whether the guy or the girl could be a model, but rather whether it puts in place a gradual, detail-focused build-up of the romantic connection between characters. So, stop complaining about the way people look. A quick reference, my favourite reference, always one of the best romance references. Mr. Darcy from Pride and Prejudice smiled 3 times in the whole of the book and the film. And everyone still went nuts over him. He had 0 riz, except the power of actually being a decent guy and him being respectfully infatuated with Elizabeth. One of the most loved shots in the whole 2005 adaptation is one of him flexing his hands, for Christ's sakes. Like, his looks were irrelevant, entirely irrelevant. And if a writer needs the guy to be hot for you to like the romance and to actually be somewhat, like, attracted to him as well, they're writing badly. And you know damn well these Bridgerton writers are top tier, and they keep getting better, as the spin-off has just proven. So this sidetrack needed to be expressed. I'm sorry, I know it's a sidetrack, but I had to say it. Also, personally, I'm here for Penelope, which is a character played by Nicola. Anyways, I feel like people have been very embarrassing when it comes to this, so that's why I wanted to say that. You know, we've watched Colin, who's played by Luke Newton, be an absolute asshole to Penny, who's played by Nicola. and we've watched her get emotionally whipped around for the last two seasons, and you're telling me that season three isn't going to be filled with enough angst to make you cry? Like, Penelope is every girl who felt small because guys never liked her. She's every girl stuck in unrequited love. Then you add the fact that she's trying to reconcile her desire for independence with the fact that she also desires children and romantic love. Like, it's gonna be fantastic. I don't know why people are worried about this season. I'm ready for begging. I'm ready for crying, for shouting, and for carriages. That's what I want from season three. And I'll die on this hill. If season three disappoints, which it won't, I'll admit defeat, but I won't have to. So, yeah. Anyways, it needed to be said. Someone had to say it, and I was going to be the person to say it. Let's get on with the book now that I've had my little Bridgerton rant. So, first off, trigger warning for the subject of rape and sexual assault and sexual harassment. I don't mean to do this, and when I genuinely mean that. I really didn't mean to have, what was it, the last? There's been quite a few of these now, probably like half of these have had like really dark topics. I don't mean to do that, and I'm sorry. I usually haven't read the book before I decide to do it for the podcast, because if I only read for the purpose of doing this podcast, I would go senile. All the only books I would ever do on this podcast would be fantasy, because that's the main genre that I can read excessively without feeling kind of burnt out after reading a lot of it. I'm sorry, though, like I genuinely am. I'm gonna try and do something fun next. It's probably gonna be fantasy, actually. I go into most of these blind with just a vague idea of what the whole thing is about, and then I kind of go from there. So that's why. Also, I can't watch films in the theatre right now because I'm not in the UK, I'm in Portugal, and it would be interesting to see if how much I understood how good my Portuguese is in the cinema. But yeah, I really want to watch Beau is Afraid because there's been so much talk about it, and also it's Ari Aster. And Pearl was just coming out in the UK, even though I think it came out in the US like ages ago, probably ages ago, but it was just coming out when I left, which was a month ago, but still. And I just feel like I really need to start watching that genre of movies, but I'm gonna watch Don't Look Up or Get Out this week. Basically anything scary, because I don't really watch that genre and I don't have that many points of reference. Also, Get Out is one of the most recent films in the Sight and Sound magazine top 250 films of all time, because most of those films are like 1970s, 1930s, 1950s, and not a lot of them are actually films that have been released even remotely recently. My April volume of that magazine is literally so tatty because I've been trying to like go through the list and it's been taken in my bag literally everywhere, so it's looking a bit raggedy. Time to get back on track, sorry. Very, very unfocused beginning. I haven't focused as much on how I would modify films to make it into a better adaptation recently. And I apologize because it's something I said I would definitely do and that I not should do, but it's kind of the point of what I'm trying to say as well. Be a bit pretentious of me just to criticize without offering my own way of solving that problem. But yeah, that's probably why I'm going to redo the Shadow and Bone episode. It's not up at the moment because I just felt like it was very convoluted and it was a bit mixed up. And there was the fact that like I was speaking at some points as though you had watched the show and at some points as if you hadn't. I feel like I should have just chosen a way to do it and it was just a bit messy. So I'm going to redo that, but the fact that I hadn't really offered like another way of doing the television series was part of what made me take it down, and it's something that it will be back up and I'll tell you when it's back up. I also feel like I'm being a kind of an asshole this week by proposing concrete alterations to the film's writing almost the same week that the Writers Guild of America commences its strike. I fully support the strikes and these incredible writers who create, you know, the foundation for many of the movies, television series, as well as radio programs, which I didn't know was part of the guild. And I hope that they receive the pay and the protections that they deserve as well. As I said, most of this is actually to do with what I would change rather than comparisons. So just presume everything else is good. I want to add as well, I can't focus on every interesting aspect of a book or film or series when I do these episodes, because that's not where the focus of this podcast is. It's on the quality of the film or series as an adaptation. Even though obviously in my notes it's all there, like that's part of what helps me evaluate whether it's a good adaptation. But maybe I need to find a way for you guys to express your additional points besides just by me through message. And maybe I need to put it somewhere else as well. Which is not to say at all that I don't like hearing them from you guys directly, but more to say that I do understand the need to find a way to present those views too, even if those views are not coming directly from me. Because I think a lot of you have really good points. I just can't cover all of them in an episode, especially not in an hour long episode where that isn't the focus. So, yeah. Okay. Let's go. We're talking about The Perks of Being a Wallflower by Stephen Chbosky. First point, it's a good film. I get why people like it. It presents this very fun, very vibrant, and very authentic portrayal of youth that many movies set in high schools often don't achieve. And it captures the experience of being a teenager very well. A lot of the quotes that you know, and a lot of quotes that have circulated around on social media are actually from this film, or they're from the book. So there are quite a few popular audios that you will have heard that are from this film. Second of all, Stephen Chbosky was directly involved with the whole thing. So the way that I criticize this adaptation is going to be a little bit different than the way that I have previously. And this contrasts greatly with American Psycho, where Bret Easton Ellis was only ever accidentally on set. Like, he kind of stumbled on set at different moments, which is very funny. As I said, Chbosky both directed this movie and wrote the screenplay, not just the book. So I actually think I might be about to come off as far more critical than I have previously, because like, he wrote the text. Oh, but it's his vision of it. I don't care. I don't. Like, you make bad choices, you make bad choices. And you know I'm never reasonable. I'm not. Like, I always get worried when I finish these and I'm like, oh, was I really mean? Was I really mean? And then I look back and I'm like, you were fine. You were fine. It's fine. But yeah. It's interesting as well. He also directed the 2017 film Wonder. And he did, I think he did the screenplay for that as well, helped with the screenplay. And he helped write the screenplay for the Beauty and the Beast live action movie. So he has been mainly doing projects which have to do with book adaptations, which is really interesting as well. Another point I'd like to make is that the ratings are different. I've never commented on this before, but I think it's very noticeable here because the book is probably minimum 15 plus as an age range, possibly even higher, possibly like 16 plus really. And the film is a 12. So a lot of the content that makes the book what it is and a lot of the topics of the book can actually only be referenced to or hinted in the film. They can't actually explicitly be spelt out or be an integral part of the film. There's such an impressive cast for this film as well. Like, it's crazy. I just kept on thinking, oh my gosh, another one, another famous actor, another incredible actor. Logan Lerman played Charlie, the main character, in the film and in the book, and he was just incredible. He genuinely was fantastic. Then you also have Emma Watson, you have Ezra Miller, you have Paul Rudd, you have Kate Walsh and Mae Whitman, just to name a few. That's not all of the famous actors in that, that film. It's quite crazy. The perspective of the film is different because the book, it's just a series of letters. The book is a collection of letters, which become a part of the narration that goes on in the film. And the only time that this shift in perspective really came into play was when the film made it seem like Patrick and Sam, who are his best friends in the book and in the film, and this shift in perspective makes it seem like they became best friends with Charlie out of pity. Because of the fact that Charlie's best friend, this is not a spoiler, but because Charlie's best friend had committed suicide. And I just found it really irritating that they made it into a situation where they made it into a very superficial situation where this bond that he has with these people who are very important to him and are very important to his growth as a person, this bond only came out of a place of pity, which I think was possible, but at the same time it diminishes this very sweet moment in the book where Charlie feels like he's finally being integrated into this kind, fun group of older teenagers who actually see him, where he's given the label of being a wallflower and where he feels seen. I just think it was a stupid alteration, and actually I found a lot of the alterations that the film made really unnecessary. Yeah, it's more will be said, but yeah. So different kind of perspective, the ability to move away from Charlie in certain scenes and just to give a more rounded view of what happened or what's going on. The book commences with Charlie just starting high school. This brand new beginning, and we find out very early on that in May of that year, his best friend Michael shot himself, committed suicide. Charlie is therefore very much alone as he starts this new chapter of his life, and so a part of this book is about Charlie trying to find his footing and being a part of this much more mature and adult friend group of seniors that he finds himself a part of. And at the same time, the reader and a bit the audience are aware that something is wrong. Something is dragging Charlie down and we don't know exactly what it is. And Charlie barely seems to know either. Charlie also offers commentary on his friends' relationships and lives with a focus on Sam and Patrick, who are his closest friends, and then also his sister. You also have commentary on family, on abusive cycles, on love, on relationships, on sexual assault, on mental health, and it's all done in this incredibly non-invasive way, which is fantastic. This was a 5 out of 5 book for me. I wouldn't have read it if it weren't for the podcast, and I don't even particularly like the writing. It's relatively short, and there's such a gorgeous amount of quotable passages that weren't in the film as well, and it does such a fantastic job at creating these very complex characters in such a short amount of pages. I went out for a walk as soon as I finished it. It's strange. It's one of those books, for me at least, that I would only recommend to someone I trusted and was very close to emotionally. It's very intimate. And no matter what reason you enjoy the book, to say that you like it is to reveal a lot about yourself, I think. And it's the kind of book you'd give to someone with a little message written in the front. And what I liked about this book is that it wasn't just a coming of age story. It's such a genuine rendition of being 15, 16, which is the age that Charlie's at in that first year of high school. And part of what I like about it is that it doesn't criticize. It's not in your face. Being 15 and 16 was rough. Like, COVID hit whilst I was 16 too. Things were already rough before that point. And literally everyone I know was having a tough time at that age. Yeah, and you're doing all of these adult things without the tools to protect yourself or regulate your reactions or your emotions. And honestly, my journals are just incredibly entertaining from that period. So being 15 and 16 is tough. And I think at the end of the day, a lot of people enjoy this book, you know, based off of the reviews that I saw and also based off the afterword, which I believe was added into the 20th anniversary edition of the book in response to the love this book received. They enjoyed this book because it tells you that things will be okay and what bad things happen to you do not define you. And how you reacted in response to your situation was not inexplicable. It's not something to hold against yourself, but rather that you have to move forward for yourself. And this message does not come from just Charlie's tale and experiences, but also from Sam, from Patrick, from his sister, his mum, his dad, and those mentioned in the book who were unable to get past what happened to them. And this isn't just a book about sexual assault and sexual abuse. It's also about all of these women trying to figure out how to stay respected while still enjoying girlhood, because it's actually a really difficult combination. And all of these boys and girls who allow themselves to be degraded and harmed for the sake of being loved. And then also healing, as well as all of the other themes I mentioned above. I don't know how many of you have read the book or even just heard of the book, My Year of Rest and Relaxation. I hated it. Sorry. But I have another one of her books at home. I can't remember what it's called. Lapvona. I have Lapvona at home, but I haven't read it yet. She writes very interesting books, but I could not get through I did get through My Year of Rest and Relaxation. What am I saying? But I got through it because I wanted to be able to hate on it correctly. Sorry. It happened. The point is that the blurb of my copy at home has this one line that says, "Whatever could be the matter?" Something along those lines. After basically describing how she's doing all these weird things and just wants to go into a drug-induced sleep coma. And basically, you don't know by the end whatever could be the matter. You don't, okay? And to be honest, the main character was so insufferable, I didn't want to apply an analytical approach towards this book. So I couldn't be asked to fill in that blank. I could, if you asked me to, but I didn't want to. And that's a whole other conversation I'd love to have. But my point is that The Perks of Being a Wallflower tells you to ask that same question implicitly and actually builds it up incredibly well and delivers the answer. You know there's something wrong with Charlie. As in, you know there's a reason he got bad and that he has depression and panic attacks and anxiety attacks and dissociates, but you don't know what that reason is. And so when you find out what happened to him, you're shocked because there are plenty of reasons why he could be suffering from all of those things, because he's gone through a lot. And of course, it's a combination of all of the things that's happened to him. But when you find out what could be perceived as like the original issue, you're gobsmacked. And I think the challenge was recreating that build up the right way. And I feel like this film didn't commit to a line from the book, which is odd considering the screenplay was written by Chbosky and it was directed by him. And maybe part of the advantage of an outsider point of view is that an outsider does have their own perception of the text, so they know what they want to emphasize rather than getting themselves lost in the text. The film lent into sensationalism, which was disappointing considering the content of the book. I sometimes felt like the film required more quietness. I don't know if any of you have watched After Sun. It was nominated for quite a few things, but I'm sure that you know what I'm talking about when I speak about quiet films. Because Charlie is quiet. Charlie observes the world. He is not an incredibly active participant in it, even though he is at the core of the storyline. And admittedly, I struggled with After Sun. There's such little dialogue in it, and it really is a collection of interactions and scenes that have an implicit purpose and that carry implicit messages and meaning. It's a really gorgeous film, by the way. Do watch it. There's a reason Charlotte Wells won Outstanding Debut at the BAFTAs as the director of this film. But I think you finish the film and you ponder it because of its quietness. And I was still thinking about it days after watching it, genuinely. And it would have been nice to have these moments with Charlie, because it's really, After Sun is very much of a film when you're watching people. You feel like you're people watching, and that's what Charlie's doing, and that's what you get to experience when you read the letters in the book. So yeah, I think it would have been nice to have those moments with Charlie, with him kind of quietly observing the people around him, especially during important moments of the book, actually, or in moments when he dissociates, because he does. On his birthday, for example, it would have been good to have him simply watching this hellish day unfurl. And it wouldn't have needed the narration as well. We wouldn't have needed the presence of his internal monologue in the form of narration either. Yeah. There's so much power in silence, I think. And our minds like to fill in the quiet. And so meaning is brought to those scenes if they're done correctly. And I just think that would have been nice. Also, just to draw a parallel, because After Sun and The Perks of Being a Wallflower are both very profound coming-of-age movies that are incredibly different, even though they're separated by only a decade. One of the other very interesting things After Sun does is mark out how kind of discovering physical intimacy and discovering physical displays of romantic love is part of growing up. It's a marker of you growing and becoming more adult. It's this 11 to 12 year old girl watching the way these teenagers interact at a holiday resort. Obviously there's nothing more than making out, nothing scandalous, and all these teenagers are very sweet to her, but you can tell she's very curious and she wants to be like these teenagers. And towards the end of the film, she has her first kiss with this boy who was at the resort with her, who was her age. And this similar message is present in The Perks of Being a Wallflower, but for Sam and for Charlie, this act of growing up through the witnessing and experiencing of physical intimacy is very violent and abrupt. And for Sam, it leads to this over-sexualization of herself. And for Charlie, he subconsciously rejects this kind of intimacy. Anyways, I just thought that acknowledgement of how important those kind of experiences are to your development was cool in both these pieces of work. Although I feel like the film adaptation of The Perks of Being a Wallflower kind of fails when it comes to marking the contrast between Sam and Charlie's reactions, and also heavily relies on Sam verbally expressing the consequences of what happened to her. And it even fails to mark the fact that Charlie is rejecting physical affection and intimacy because of it. Because it makes this one slight alteration that's completely unnecessary. Yeah, I think sometimes, oh my gosh, this is gonna sound so mean. I think sometimes almost authors forget how clever they are. And I felt that in this one. I was like, why would you change that? Why would you change that? Why would you change that for so many things? Because the symbolism behind and the meaning behind certain actions was so subtle but so clever, and then it just got ruined because they just altered it for no apparent reason. Anyways, that very destructive process of over-sexualization that Sam went through as a result of her assault is not something that is happening so much at the time the book takes place, although one could argue that her relationship with her college student boyfriend Craig is also a byproduct of it. However, this character named Susan, whose best friend used to be Michael, so the friend who shot himself, and that she was very close with and she was in brackets going out with at the time, she is a very real present version of that old Sam, in the sense that she allows herself to be degraded and sexualized by her group of boy friends, again, in brackets, for the sake of moving onwards and dealing with this new body that she's grown into, that's bringing on all this attention. And she's not referenced too much in the book, and even less so in the film, but to me she was very emblematic of how girls react, or more what they'll put up with or put themselves through in these times of vulnerability because of what's expected of them, with those expectations being put on them through the way that they have been treated or are being treated. I hope that makes sense. And Susan is kind of every girl who body grew up too quickly for their age, and I would have liked having her at least a bit more in the film. Not no more than it was in the book, but just it would have taken like one scene. Back to quiet moments. I know it's hard to adapt lols in a book, and this was done in the 2010s, and the coming of age movie was much more exclusive to a certain type of style of movie too. And there's a reason that Charlotte Wells won Outstanding Debut Director, because she did something which was rather original. But maybe we could have had a few more moments of scenes with just music, because music is so important in the book. Charlie regularly loses track of time, or registers he's about to lose himself, about to lose his attachment to reality. And I think this film needed to indulge in that passing of time. For example, okay, this is a spoiler on part of how the book ends, but not really the big thing that shouldn't be spoiled, so don't worry. Like, it's the main thing that you don't want to be spoiled is not spoiled in this. In the book, he doesn't try to kill himself at the end, like he does in the film. He just completely clocks out for a whole week. He's found naked on the couch, staring at the television, completely unresponsive after having this panic attack. And I don't know how many of you have watched Pride and Prejudice, but there's a scene where Elizabeth is just, look at me referencing Pride and Prejudice again. I just, like, I really love that film. That's a really good film. Anyways, I haven't even watched it recently. I don't know why this whole entire episode is, like, low-key Pride and Prejudice themed, even though this isn't, like, a romance book at all. But anyways, sorry. So, I don't know how many of you have watched Pride and Prejudice. I actually don't think a lot of you have. But there's this scene where Elizabeth, who's the main female character, is just completely flabbergasted by Mr. Darcy, his presence, his feelings towards her that he's just admitted, and how she knows he's negatively affected her life and that of her family and her sister, like her closest sister, her best friend. And so she just stands in front of this mirror, kind of like shell-shocked. And we know that time flies by because the light fades and a candle is lit, and we can see the light traveling across her face and across the room behind her. And then Mr. Darcy abruptly enters and leaves this letter for her. And then she starts reading this letter, and you have Mr. Darcy narrating the reading of this letter. And I think that scene should have looked like that, with this very visual passing of time stopping either when his family finds him that way in front of the television, or when he regains consciousness in the hospital. I also I did think about the Twilight in Twilight as well, when I was thinking about how you adapt time. You know, there's three chapters in the book, and I think it's the second book, with just the names of the month. They were actually brilliantly adapted. I love the acknowledgement of time in that film. Go watch Twilight. And there is this time transition done in the diner, in The Perks of Being a Wallflower, through the changing of these posters. And it was a good transition, but the phenomenon, the genuine feeling of time passing, wasn't really there. It was just kind of a time jump. You need to savor. Savor time. Present time. Show me time. Which is something that Pride and Prejudice does actually do quite well. So, time to go into detail as to what I would have changed. I thought about this for a while, mainly because we didn't have any Wi-Fi, as I said, and so my brain had little else to think about. And so I was trying to think of a way that was remotely original, that didn't just involve adding parts of the book in. Because what I've mentioned so far has been mainly like small alterations that could have been part of it, or that I didn't really understand, or just me highlighting things that were important and that would have been nice. But now I'm going to explain more what I would have changed and what I think was really important, and like what I would consider to be like a big alteration compared to the original film. So on the one hand, you have these things that have happened to Charlie and that he's witnessed and oftentimes not understood because he's been 15 or younger. And when you're 14, 15, you're truly starting that progression towards being an adult. You really genuinely shouldn't perceive yourself as an adult yet. Even at 17, you're not an adult yet. 18, not an adult yet. Like, I'm 19. You're not an adult. You're not an actual adult. And I swear, if you think you're an adult because of the things you've done or are doing when you're 14, 15, 16, 17, you're not either. Okay? There's a lot you're still not able to process at that age because you're wrapped up in school, because you're young, because you're learning the meaning of things and actions, and of course you start developing a sense of self as of the age of like 7, 8, but your actual like core identity and who you're gonna be for the rest of your life starts properly being formed at this, like at 15, 16, 17, starting like around 14. And you're learning the meaning of things and actions. And all of this is what Charlie is having to deal with and trying to navigate. And there are three big things that happen to Charlie in the book, which could be used in what I'm going to propose and should have been more present in the film. Spoilers, of course. Like, I don't spell out what's happened to Charlie, but this next part will give you quite a few clues, so I apologize. First and foremost, flashbacks. We need flashbacks. There were flashbacks in the film, but they were all specifically and only surrounding Aunt Helen, which was a dead giveaway that something to do with her was wrong. And they weren't used enough to create the idea that something's wrong, we don't know what. And there should have been three zone outs or flashbacks in particular. One which goes back to the scene that's described in the book, which is the counseling session that happens between all of Michael, so the best friend of Charlie who shot himself, and it's this counseling session which was with all of the people who were kind of close to Michael. And that very famous quote, which is, "My best friend Michael, his dad was a big drinker, so he hated all of that stuff, parties too." And this is actually an interaction between Sam and Charlie, and Sam goes, "Well, where is Michael tonight?" And Charlie goes, "Oh, he shot himself last May. I kind of wish he'd left a note, you know what I mean?" Yeah, that's about him. So that should have been the first flashback should have been actually referring to the counseling session where Charlie cries, like, it's obviously affected him a lot. These kids are traumatized. But one of the first things where we're like, okay, this is probably the reason why Charlie is struggling. And then you find out that he's witnessed someone being raped, but he didn't know at the time that was what was going on. He just remembers it. And he later asks Sam about it, and she says, yes, that's what happened. Rape is what happened in that thing that you remember. And then the last flashback should be, maybe not the last flash, this isn't in chronological order, but another one of the flashbacks should be Aunt Helen leaving on Christmas Eve to go get Charlie's birthday present on his birthday, because that day, that moment is the catalyst. It's the focal point of everything that's wrong for Charlie. But then I would have liked to have the version of Charlie from the Christmas flashback being present in scenes, not as a central focus, but just there throughout the film at random scenes doing random things. And Christmas Charlie is very young. He's like, I don't know how old he is specifically. I don't think it's mentioned in the book. I think he's like 7 or 8, maybe younger actually. So very young, obviously very clearly a young child. And Charlie's birthday is on the 24th of December, and that's the day his aunt dies. So it's a very upsetting day for him. And I personally think that what would have been insane as a detail would have been having young Christmas Charlie there at the table on his birthday, on Christmas Eve, when Charlie and his brother are talking, and Charlie's brother asks if Charlie has been doing well, and just having young Charlie at the table for the first time. And I don't want Charlie to acknowledge Christmas Charlie at that point. Christmas Charlie is the Charlie frozen by what this day, what his birthday represents. So he has to be there. And we, the audience, should see how he still fits into Charlie's current life, even after we receive the flashback contextualizing him. And of course, after this point, after we see the flashback, after we see him at the dinner table with Charlie, which is when, also Christmas, past Christmas is when the concept of Christmas Charlie becomes more of a thing, as in like the idea of there being a connection to the past. Charlie starts to see a psychiatrist after the new year, and the psychiatrist keeps asking him questions and more questions about his childhood as the session progresses. So Christmas Charlie gets closer to current Charlie, if that makes sense. I think that makes sense. So this is definitely the right time for us to finally have our attention on this Charlie. And then Charlie, current Charlie, should finally see Christmas Charlie in his panic attack at Sam and Patrick's house towards the end of the book. Because that's what he's been unable to do the whole time. He's been unable to face this younger version of Charlie and to face what he represents. And obviously the presence of Christmas Charlie would have to be subtle, because otherwise it'd be creepy. It's not supposed to be a horror movie. He could just be there as a natural part of a scene doing things. But I think it could really work. No obvious changes in the meantime. No obvious music shift or focus on young Christmas Charlie. Nothing, just him there, waiting for Charlie to see him. And I think that would be a good way to show how the remnants of traumatic events persist when unattended to, but also how facing that trauma is an integral part of diminishing how much space they occupy in lives, as well as letting us move forward. Also admit, including a scene where someone is audibly being forced to have sex with someone would increase the rating, and I don't know how to work around that yet, so maybe that isn't there. But yeah, Charlie overheard it, and it's a traumatic thing, and probably definitely contributes to the trauma that he's feeling, so I feel like it should have been there. But the ratings would have been difficult, and I admit that. I admit that being a problem. I think it's really important to maintain the fact that we don't know what's wrong until the end, and also that many things have happened to poor Charlie, because I think to do otherwise would be to go against the message of this book, which is, these things have happened to me, I must acknowledge them, but I must also keep going, keep living, because good things await. And this knowledge and understanding of what has happened to me is a relief. It is a good thing, even when it's about something bad. And the film leads to this very dramatic, very quick build-up, actually, which led you going, oh my god, this is terrible, this terrible thing happened and this is awful, which of course you do feel when you finish the book, but your sentiments towards the end of the book are a lot less, like, as I said before, you are gobsmacked, but you're not like, whoa, crazy. At the same time, you're thinking, he knows. He knows what the problem is. He has proper help now. He can get through this, and he will get through this. We know that he'll get through this now. And you feel a much more quiet, much more personal, actual happiness for Charlie, rather than just having a shock factor reaction. And actually, despite the ending being cool, then cinematically speaking, and looking nice, it was upsetting to see how they chose sensationalism over trying to replicate the book, because instead of trying to recreate the final scene of the book correctly, where even in this moment of sheer personal pain, Charlie is still trying to comfort himself, the last thing he remembers doing is sending the final letter, telling us that something is wrong, telling us what had happened to him, even though he doesn't fully understand himself. The last thing he did was try and cope through writing, which is what he's been trying to do the whole book by writing these letters. And then his brain placed him in front of the television, a place where he sought out companionship from his family in their presence and tried to find comfort in their presence, and where one of the worst things imaginable for a small child to go through happened to him. He was trying, even in those final moments when his mind was shutting down, he was trying. I mean, even the fact that he was naked in front of the television, because he's found naked in front of the television, which isn't turned on, even the fact that he was naked can be linked back to this silly moment that's described in the book from his childhood, where he walked around outside naked with an umbrella and some boots on, I believe, which he remembers fondly because his mother found it incredibly amusing. It's so heartbreaking as a final scene because, you know, even at the end, even after he realizes the weight of what he's gone through and the deception and the breaking of this trust that he had in this person, years after the deception was committed, this is still a boy who wants to keep going, who's still trying. Right till his brain shut down on him, he was trying to self-soothe, he was trying to find a way through it. And that's what Charlie has been trying to do most of the book too. So the idea of him killing himself defeats the purpose and the concept of this Charlie still trying, still moving forward, still wanting to be better, to feel better, to get past this darkness and this depression that he's feeling. I really don't approve of the way they changed the end of the book for the film at all. It was stupid. So stupid. For no point. And it completely lacked sense to me. I just don't get it. The concept of self-soothing is also heavily linked with substance abuse in this book. Another thing that was neglected in the film. At some point, Charlie is smoking 10 cigarettes a day. He's smoking pot to get through loneliness towards the end of the book. And these links are, it's quite clearly drawn that the reason why he does those things is because he's trying to cope with stuff going on in his personal life. And Patrick is drinking copious amounts of alcohol to deal with his struggles too. And it's just not there. And the thing is especially for Charlie, it takes one line of dialogue, now I smoke 10 cigarettes a day after describing struggling with the effects of LSD, for us to know that, like, we're talking about substance abuse, we're talking about coping by using substance, in this situation, one substance feeding into the addiction of another. Like, that is all it took for you to add that into it. They just don't. And also, the concept of abusive cycles and healing and moving forwards is important, you know, outside of Charlie. Sometimes You do need to spell things out for the audience. Sometimes it's okay. Just let out a piece of clear dialogue going, my Aunt Helen was molested as a young child and suffered from drug addiction and alcoholism and was trying to get back on track. Or even just include the fact that his dad didn't want to ever hit his kids and only did it once to Charlie because he upset Aunt Helen, and then his father deeply apologized for hitting him. I know they don't have time to show how all of Charlie's extended and nuclear family is a testament to harmful cycles and generational trauma and the breaking of those cycles, but spell it out then. Spelling out is okay sometimes if you just need to get a theme in there. Try and get a theme in there. So yeah. I saw a joke about how excited people get over realistic portrayals of panic attacks and anxiety attacks, but I do think people, like, genuinely, they do take comfort in seeing them, and I find it amusing as well. I find it amusing when I get so excited, but it does come from a quite sad need for mental illnesses to be recognized. And I did think it was a shame that the less spoken symptoms of anxiety, which are a massive part of what's happening to Charlie, weren't even, you know, attempted to be addressed in the film, such as derealization, which from the NHS website means another type of dissociation where you feel disconnected from the world around you, or like the world isn't real, and depersonalization, a type of dissociation where you feel disconnected from your mind or body, or like you're a character that you are watching in a film. And Charlie does often worry about losing touch with reality. I would have liked to see that just acknowledged as something that he's going through, and it wasn't, to the point I felt like they actually forgot what some of the scenes were originally presenting and offering. I'm not gonna give you examples for all of the little subtle changes that they made. Their LSD scene where he's in the hospital was altered and was stupid. And that's the only analytical response I'm going to give. Yeah. There were so many subtle changes that were just poor, poor changes. But I like this film fully, but I don't know. I don't know why they changed some stuff. We had, as I mentioned, okay, sorry, this is a side. We had, as I mentioned, we had no Wi-Fi, like, on and off last week. So sometimes we did, sometimes we didn't. So me and my grandma spent, like, a lot of time in cafes or the library. And so Thursday, I was on the NHS website checking the symptoms of an anxiety attack to mark the distinction between anxiety attacks and panic attacks, which, just as a point of reference, anxiety attacks are much longer than panic attacks and usually are associated with much milder symptoms than a panic attack. And basically, the NHS website I was on has this massive font, which is fine. But, like, I kept looking around me to see if anyone was looking at me in, like, this super crowded cafe, because it looked like I was basically signalling that I was having some form of anxiety-induced attack. I just thought it was really funny. Yeah. And I, like, okay, I'm not going to talk too much about, I could talk about the portrayal of mental illness in this film, but I'm not, because it takes too long. And actually, I think, generally speaking, films are quite good at it, so I'm not going to go into detail over this one. But yeah, I'll admit to being harsh on this film, and being harsh about the alterations that were made. And I really wanted to go into how the female characters got completely dashed in this film as well. I just hate it. It's always us. It's always us who have our plot lines diminished. And I'll do a full episode at some point. Someone remind me. I will, because it deserves to have its own place instead of just me feeling like I'm nagging people at the end of every episode over this. But it's just ridiculous at this point how often the first thing to go when a book is getting adapted is the complexity of any female character, and then any, like, commentary on gender relations is ridiculous. But anyways, I'm probably being harsh because I really like this book, and it's one of the few books I've ever given a 5 out of 5. You know, I'd still give this, I give this a 7 out of 10 for, as an adaptation. The acting was incredible. The actors were fantastic. Because of the fact that some of the dialogue was just didn't really fit into the tone of the book. Sometimes the tone was off compared to the characters. I just found the nuance lacking where it could have been just by changing things and without even adding extra scenes, you know? Like, I could have made most of the alterations that I have marked here. I haven't told you guys everything, of course. I feel like I could have made most of my alterations whilst changing very little. I just didn't get the full sense of the message of the book, which is what pulled people to the book. I didn't get the full sense of someone moving towards a place of healing to break the cycle that they were stuck in because of what happened to them, and I didn't get the sense of that movement or that evolution. Yeah. I just feel for a book that was just so fantastic, this disappointed me. And I don't think you would find it disappointing if you watched the film on its own, but because I'm looking at it and I'm going through it and I'm picking out the changes, I can see where it was disappointing and where it fell flat. And so where the book is clever, the film is good rather than fantastic and brilliant and excellent. To end on a happier note, I thought I would give you some of my favourite quotes that are in the book but not in the film, because you cannot guess the sheer amount of famous quotes that come from this book unless you read it, and that's why I'll stand by the statement that the book is criminally underrated, even though it sold like 1.5 million copies as of 2016. And I don't think these quotes necessarily needed to be in the film at all. I just really like these quotes and I just wanted to share them. So the first one is page 55 of the 20th anniversary edition, on holidays with family, and it is, "I am very interested and fascinated by how everyone loves each other, but no one really likes each other." And then my second other favourite quote is, "I want Sam to stop liking Craig. Now, I guess maybe you think that's because I'm jealous of him. I'm not. Honest. It's just that Craig doesn't really listen to her when she talks. I don't mean that he's a bad guy, because he's not. It's just that he always looks distracted. It's like he would take a photograph of Sam, and the photograph would be beautiful, and he would think that the reason the photograph was beautiful was because of how he took it. If I took it, I would know that the only reason it's beautiful is because of Sam." I was clutching my chest when reading that one. He has so many beautiful quotes surrounding Sam, and they're very cute. Again, I'm sorry for the late episode. Next time, I'm gonna do something more fun. I don't know what yet, but it's gonna be fun. And if it's not fun, I'm only gonna focus on the fun, and it's just gonna be fun. Will the next episode actually be on Bridgerton? Who knows? I found out today that Lockwood & Co. has been cancelled, which is devastating, and is another book to television series adaptation, and I'm thinking that Shadow and Bone is not going to get renewed for another season either, which is upsetting. There's not that much to do. Everything's a bit of a mess at the moment because people are not getting paid enough. A brand new week starts tomorrow though. I hope you enjoy. Social media links will be in the description below. Sources will be in the description below. I hope you enjoyed, and I hope you enjoy your week. Bye!